Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It is often said that we are living through the sixth mass extinction event in the Earth's history. But unlike previous mass extinctions, this one is of our own making. In his timely and fascinating new book, Catastrophic Thinking, David Sapkowski delves into the history of this idea. When did human beings first come to believe that some organisms truly disappeared from the face of the globe? And how did they begin to understand the complex biological processes that cause entire species to go extinct? Finally, what led geologists and paleontologists to believe that Earth history is punctuated by dramatic moments of biological upheaval, in which entire ecosystems are almost completely wiped out and replaced with something new? To answer these questions, Sapkowski traces the cultural and intellectual history of what he calls an extinction imaginary from the 18th century into the present day. In so doing, he makes a powerful argument that the history of extinction reflects how our social anxieties and cultural preoccupations have changed over time. To quote him directly, "The way that we understand extinction, the extinction imaginary of any given time, is ultimately tied to the way that we conceive of the basic stability and security of the continued existence of our own species." In particular, he shows how changing ideas about the value of diversity have shaped the history of extinction. If it seems self-evident to most of us now that diverse ecosystems and societies are intrinsically valuable, that is a relatively recent development. In fact, Sapkowski argues, the way that we value diversity depends crucially on our sense that it is precarious, that it is something actively threatened, and that its loss could have profound consequences. In Catastrophic Thinking, Sapkowski uncovers how and why we learn to value diversity as a precious resource at the same time that we learn to think catastrophically about extinction. This is a fabulous book, expertly weaving cultural and intellectual history into a rich tapestry of ideas about loss, precarity, and diversity, whose relevance and significance can hardly be overstated. Sapkowski takes readers on an eye-opening journey into a history that remains surprisingly little known, despite its obvious importance given the catastrophic biodiversity crisis we currently face. It's an absolute pleasure to read. Welcome, David, to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you for having me, Lucas.
So why don't we start by just having you tell us a little bit about how you came to the project that you write about in your new book.
Sure. So about nearly 10 years ago now, I guess 8 years ago, I published a book, Rereading the Fossil Record, which was a kind of intellectual and scientific history of paleontology and paleobiology in the 20th century. And it dealt with a lot of the scientific themes that appear in my new book, things like mass extinctions and biodiversity over time, but in a very, I guess you could say, internalist kind of context. And I really felt that there were important cultural considerations that needed to be taken into account. I was particularly interested in the reasons why paleontologists, but also kind of people in the broader culture at large, either accepted or didn't accept particular ideas or attitudes about extinction, particularly mass extinction, at different times. So it's probably somewhat familiar to listeners, but maybe not to everybody, that the notion of mass extinction, right? The idea that large groups of taxa, of species, genera, families, etc., could become extinct in a coordinated fashion fairly suddenly, at particular moments in the fossil record. That idea was actually first introduced right at the beginning of scientific acceptance of extinction. Georges Cuvier, the French naturalist, introduced that idea in the very early 19th century, and it came to be known as catastrophism because Cuvier talked about these massive revolutions that periodically alter the composition of the Earth itself and life on Earth. But that idea was pretty quickly rejected by the Scottish geologist Charles Lyell and, of course, Charles Darwin. And the mainstream attitude among not just paleontologists, but I think, you know, biologists in general over the next about 100 years was that these mass extinctions really either don't happen at all or aren't a significant feature in the history of life. And then all of a sudden, there was a kind of rebirth of catastrophism in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where mass extinctions were reintroduced as important events in the history of life, perhaps even events that have definitively shaped the Earth's current biota. And then, of course, this dovetailed with interest in current biodiversity, concerns about a biodiversity crisis that we're living in now, which has been labeled by some people to be a sixth extinction. So the question is, you know, why did this shift take place, right? Going from, you know, a kind of a catastrophist view 200 years ago to what, you know, kind of was characterized as, in contrast, as a uniformitarian view in which mass extinctions don't really take place for the later 19th century and much of the 20th century, to back to a catastrophist view. And, you know, all along, I couldn't help thinking that there had to be really important cultural, political, social influences at play here as well. And I think that most historians of science now accept that you can't really neatly separate scientific, cultural, and political, you know, factors from one another. But this seemed like a really interesting case study to try to look at how these, a particular confluence of both scientific and broader cultural factors took shape. Like, for example, I couldn't help but think that a key influence on somebody like Cuvier promoting a theory of catastrophic mass extinctions, which he, by the way, called revolutions, you know, having himself lived through the French Revolution, that had to be significant, that people like Lyell and Darwin, other particularly English naturalists, kind of rejecting a catastrophic view in favor of one that's much more kind of continuous and progressive in the Victorian era, that had to be significant. And then that the rekindling of catastrophism sort of at the height of the Cold War, so it really might reflect late Cold War anxieties, you know, that was always a hypothesis in the back of my head. So in some ways, this book was a means to test the hypothesis, but it was also, of course, motivated by what Naomi Oreskes calls, you know, motivational or methodological presentism. I think it's motivational presentism. In historians that maybe we write about issues historically, that we historicize issues that are of, you know, keen contemporary interest. Well, obviously, in the era of the so-called Anthropocene, we're very concerned about things like climate change, biodiversity loss, perhaps a sixth mass extinction. This seemed like a story that had particular relevance. So it wasn't just, you know, testing out kind of, you know, a hypothesis about the interaction between culture and science. It was one that is of particular relevance to our society. So this book had really been kind of percolating in the back of my head for quite a long time. And I finally had the time to sit down and work through it. And, you know, it arrived at a moment when I think we're all thinking a little bit catastrophically. And that's a deeper message, is that the way that we think about the present and the future is often very much tied to our imaginations about the past, right? And in the book, I talk about an extinction imaginary, because thinking about extinction doesn't just lead us to, you know, make particular choices. It's not just a matter of a kind of rational scientific calculus. It's a matter of how we imagine certain things about ourselves and our own societies. And one of the crucial things that I argue this extinction imaginary is tied to is the way that we understand diversity, both biological and cultural.
So one thing that is super interesting about your book is that one of the main characters in this neo-catastrophist moment in kind of the second half of the 20th century, one of the protagonists of the kind of legitimization of catastrophist thinking again, is your own father, your late father, Jack Sapkowski. And as someone who is himself the child of a paleontologist, my father is also a paleontologist. Although I have not written about the kind of research that my father does.
I'm just going to interject Olivier Rippel here, and a historian and philosopher of science of some, I think, distinction. I really enjoy his work on particularly early 20th century biology in Nazi fascist context.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, David.
Sure.
So I was curious to hear you talk a little bit about how you're... So when I asked you about how you came to the project, you gave a sort of intellectual biography that started with the previous book that you wrote, in which your father also plays an important role, and how that kind of story that you told in that book led you to thinking in broader cultural terms about extinction. But I want to ask you just more generally, like how your family history and your personal history impacted, or just how do you think about the way that your own personal relationship with your late father has led you to the kinds of questions that you ask, and if that's something that, anyway, just if, how you deal with those personal questions
sure.
in your scholarly research.
Sure. Okay. Well, we're gonna get personal right away. That sounds good. So my father, yes, Jack Sapkowski, was a paleobiologist who was involved in basically the a turn in the late 1970s, early 1980s towards the quantification of the fossil past. He built one of the first, actually the first computer database of the fossil record and used that database to analyze patterns in the fossil record. And among other things, he and his colleague at the University of Chicago, Dave Raup, the late Dave Raup, who passed away just a couple of years ago, while I was finishing the book. And in fact, one of the people to whom the book is dedicated is Dave Raup. He was a really wonderful guy who gave me a lot of help with the book towards the end. They documented the existence of the so-called Big Five mass extinctions in the Earth's past, the most recent of which was the extinction at the, I'm going to still call it Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, even though I'm sure that geologists listening will object to that, when the dinosaurs became extinct. These were signals that had been detected in the stratigraphic record by paleontologists for, you know, decades, if not hundreds of years, but they were able to, Raup and my dad were able to document, you know, the kind of the broader contours of these events by looking at fossil data from the marine.
Such an interesting story. Do you want to just tell our listeners a little bit about this sort of backbreaking research that your father did, like where this data actually came from, how he gathered this data?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, and I'll try not to be long about it. And interested readers, you can learn a little bit about it in this book. I do tell the story in this book if you really want to dig into it. My rereading the fossil record really, really goes into it. But essentially, in the early 1970s, a group of maverick paleontologists, including Stephen Jay Gould, Dave Raup, who I mentioned, Thomas Schopf, who was an important paleontologist who died when he was only 44 years old, I think, in the early 1980s, so not many people know about him, all got together and were interested in trying to figure out new approaches to paleontology that would kind of make paleontology more like physics or something like that, right? They would use a lot of computer techniques, advanced statistical techniques to kind of model the fossil past. And one of the things that they got very interested in doing was actually simulating evolution, simulating the process by which speciation and extinction occur using some fairly simple computer models. At the same time, though, Gould in particular was very interested in trying to apply these techniques to real fossil data. The problem was there wasn't any large, high-quality database available. I mean, there were a lot of older data sources that existed in various paper formats scattered all over the world. There had been some efforts, particularly in the 19th century, but also in the 20th century, to create these compendia of taxonomic groups, of fossil taxonomic groups. But nothing existed that was accessible, you know, digitally at that point. And so my dad, who was a graduate student at Harvard and working with Steve Gould on a completely unrelated dissertation project, got tasked with doing that. My dad said, hey, grad student, here, you do this. So my dad started this process ostensibly just to kind of help out with Gould and Schopf and Raup's project. And eventually he became a collaborator. But his work on this actually outlived that project, which they dropped within a few years. And throughout the later 1970s, my dad kind of worked fairly tirelessly, kind of on the side, right? Not really during his normal working hours, to assemble a database drawn from all the paper documentation that existed kind of everywhere in the world. I mean, he would visit libraries in other countries when he traveled to conferences and things like that, right? I mean, this is all basically pre-internet. I mean, you know, DARPANET existed, but this was pre-internet, really. So he had to do this. He wrote a funny essay about this called 10 Years in the Library, which talks about this effort. And he painstakingly assembled this database, which is really quite simple. It was just first and last appearances of taxonomic groups. He began at the family level and ultimately moved down to the genus level. Species level is just, there's not reliable enough data at that level. It's too fragmentary. And ultimately, he first did it by hand on yellow legal pads. And I can still remember him sitting in front of the TV, like watching a football game or something, just, you know, entering in this information because it's really boring. Eventually, he put it into a computer, just to basically what, you know, what would be like an Excel file now. I mean, just a very simple database, which came to be known as the Sepkoski database, which he distributed to friends via floppy disks, and eventually you could buy it. It's gone through several iterations. It now lives in a very, very different form online as the paleobiology database. Actually, there are two paleobiology databases. That's an interesting story because the people who managed that database couldn't get along. And so there are now two online databases that sort of claim to be descendants of my dad's original
database. Speciation event, yeah.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, it was the start of an era in which some paleontologists or paleobiologists essentially became informaticians, right? There was a kind of informatics turn that my dad and Dave Raup, whose importance I really don't want to diminish at all, he was really a quite remarkable scientist, kind of spurred this. And it also became known as the Chicago School of Paleontology because a lot of this happened at the University of Chicago, and current faculty kind of still maintain that. Dave Jablonski and Michael Foote in particular still do this kind of work. And it basically follows up on trends that began in ecology, for example, in the 1950s with G. Evelyn Hutchinson at Yale, who advised important people like Robert MacArthur and sort of tangentially E.O. Wilson and Daniel Cimbraloff. A kind of modeling heuristic approach to analyzing ecological or biological data sets. And you know, my dad and others kind of picked that up and carried it on into paleontology. And it really is the foundation for the way that we understand not just the dynamics of how mass extinctions happened or when they happened or that they happened, but also what their consequences are. So people like, I mean, my dad did some of this work, but people like Jablonski have really carried this further, really analyzing the important and complex ecological dynamics and evolutionary consequences of mass extinctions, which, as the later chapters of catastrophic thinking argue, was foundational for the way that we currently understand biological diversity and the threat of a potential sixth extinction.
So that leads directly into the next question I wanted to ask, so thank you, which is about the connection between extinction, what you call the extinction imaginary, and the way that we as a culture, as a society, value diversity. So where do you see that connection? How do you understand that connection? And what's the importance of the values that we ascribe or do not ascribe to diversity for the extinction imaginary?
Yeah, so I think maybe what you're asking is how do I make the leap from ideas about, well, first what the argument is about biological diversity, and then are you asking how I make a leap from from biological diversity to perhaps how we think about cultural diversity?
Sure. So why don't we start with biological diversity, and then you can speak more broadly about diversity.
Yeah, well, so the biological diversity argument, I think, is pretty straightforward. In the 19th century, in the Victorian era, when people like Lyell and Darwin were really kind of figuring out how the fossil record might be useful for understanding not just evolution, but the ecological, we might call it, although that's anachronistic, arrangement of the Earth's biota, the assumption was that diversity, if we understand diversity simply as kind of the net number of different kinds of groups of organisms alive at any given time, was a stable value, right? That Darwin famously said pretty straightforwardly in The Origin of Species that, you know, diversity has been more or less, he didn't use the term, but has been more or less stable throughout the history of life. There have more or less always been essentially the same number of different taxonomic groups occupying the same number of, again, this is anachronistic, ecological niches, or as Lyell or Darwin would have referred to it, stations, right? And he's leaning very heavily on Lyell here. This was an argument that Lyell made. Darwin justifies this view with the mechanism of natural selection. He essentially argues that extinction is going to be the consequence of natural selection, in that when, you know, one group survives or, you know, even speciates, another group is going to get pushed out and is going to become extinct. So Lyell had argued that this was kind of happening all the time. Darwin put it into an evolutionary context with natural selection. And essentially what you get is a steady state, right? And Lyell loves steady states. It's a kind of dynamic equilibrium where, and Lyell puts it beautifully, and I quote him, and I can't remember the exact quote offhand, so I won't try to do an exact version of it. But Lyell basically argues that, you know, the extirpation of any one thing is the consequence of, you know, the survival of another. And so that becomes central to the logic of Darwin's natural selection and his bigger picture of evolution. So a concern about biological diversity just wasn't present among Victorian era naturalists. The assumption was that the balance of nature, which had very, very heavy quasi-religious overtones. This is an idea that goes back to Linnaeus and earlier, of course, but especially to Linnaeus, who very explicitly argued that God wouldn't suffer, you know, a permanent diminution of, you know, species. So it has these quasi-religious overtones, and it's kind of an article of faith that, you know, nature basically repairs itself as it goes along. So why worry about biological diversity, you know? And that even extended, right, in that era, to political and cultural attitudes about imperialism, right? The idea that flora and fauna encountered by Europeans being, you know, replaced with European flora and fauna, the idea that that could be a concern, you know, really didn't exist, nor did much concern about the potential extermination or assimilation of cultures that Europeans encountered. And again, in the first part of the book, I document this. There are other people who've written even more extensively about these attitudes in the 19th century. Patrick Brantlinger is one person. Sadia Qureshi is working on some terrific, he's working on a book and has done some terrific work on this subject as well. So what I argue is essentially that, you know, diversity was not a value at the time. It was not considered something that needed to be protected. And I think that you can go fairly easily from Victorian attitudes about biological diversity to Victorian attitudes about cultural diversity. At most, Victorian commenters argued that scientists should try to collect as much information as they could about cultures before they were exterminated, but they more or less view that disappearance as inevitable, like the inevitable disappearance of, you know, flora and fauna when faced with competition for their, you know, ecological stations.
Not just inevitable. I mean, in the book, you say that it's in fact a kind of mark of progress, so something that in some cases could even be celebrated. Which
absolutely,
I thought,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's absolutely right. And in fact, Alfred Russel Wallace, right, who co-discovered The Principle of Natural Selection, wrote a remarkable 1864 essay, which he concluded that the evolution of human beings would inevitably result in a more homogeneous human society, as kind of every human group caught up to the same level of progress. And he viewed this, he called this as bright a paradise as ever seen by seer or poet, I think is the line that he puts in there. So yeah, I mean, this was seen as a positive value. Now, I mean, you obviously fast forward to the present and we don't think that way, right? For the most part in Western societies, we tend not to, right, assume that one culture is, you know, superior to another. We certainly worry about the ecological stability that is presented by biological diversity. And so one thing that the book does is tries to reconstruct kind of how that happened in some broad strokes. One major influence was the rediscovery of mass extinctions, right? So Darwin's logic and Lyell's logic really only works if you assume that extinction is happening piecemeal, right? If it is the flip side of natural selection. It doesn't work if you have these coordinated events in which the, you know, biota is, you know, essentially being wiped out and replaced by, you know, by something new. Certainly not if you take the view that extinction events have consequences by depleting the, I guess, kind of, you know, global gene pool and limiting, putting a constraint on what can potentially evolve in the future. And so from a purely scientific perspective, you know, two important threads are in the 20th century, the rediscovery of mass extinction and also genetic arguments made by people like Theodosius Dobzhansky in the 1940s and 1950s, that diversity in the genome, right, is a kind of hedge against unexpected events, right? So populations that have a more diverse selection of genes are more able to withstand, say, like an environmental catastrophe or some other event that shakes up the population. And so it's very straightforward. I essentially argue that, you know, modern biodiversity thinking, you know, the kind promoted by Ed Wilson and other people beginning in the late 1980s and especially 1990s, draws directly from those two insights. First, that coordinated mass extinctions do happen and are events of such magnitude that, you know, the normal processes of natural selection can't really operate according to their normal workings. And secondly, that diversity in itself, whether it's genes or anything else, can be a hedge against unexpected events or, you know, catastrophic change. And the final piece of the puzzle is, you know, from the cultural standpoint, is how that argument kind of makes its way into also, I think, the cultural discourse. And one way of tracing that is just to look at discussions about what's called biocultural diversity that began in the 1990s and early 2000s, essentially arguing that the endangerment of languages and other cultural traditions is directly analogous to biodiversity. So you can actually see people who are concerned about like the extinction of languages or the eradication of particular indigenous knowledge traditions and things like that, explicitly saying this is just like biodiversity and using biodiversity as an analogy. But I think deeper than that, if you just look at some of the assumptions and language around cultural diversity, it's very clear that especially that kind of genetic stability argument is being used. But why do we think on our college campuses, for example, it's good to have students from a variety of different traditions, backgrounds, socioeconomic status, et cetera? Well, it's generally argued because it's healthy, right? It's healthier for the system. And this is really interesting. This would probably be a tangent that we don't necessarily need to follow up, but, you know, I find it very interesting that, people who conservatives who attack affirmative action attempt to kind of use a version of that argument, right? They say, well, why should we be privileging one particular group or a couple of particular groups, let's say African-Americans or women or something like that? You know, in fact, if we really believe in diversity, we ought to have, you know, more conservatives like us or whatever, you know, more white, you know, we can't just have, you know, women and people of color. We need, you know, white people too, to, you know, to keep our diversity up. And of course, that completely misunderstands the purpose of affirmative action, which is not actually built upon the logic of diversity, but rather on the logic of you know, racial justice and you know, rectifying historical wrongs. But it's amazing the way this thinking, I think, without a whole lot of, you know, self-awareness, this essentially ecological thinking, right? Ecological thinking about diversity has crept into our cultural diversity discourse. And I mean, there's probably, you know, another book or books to be written more about the cultural side of things. I only sort of allude to this connection in my book, but I really truly do believe that, you know, that this ecological way of thinking is something that has marked our culture since about the early 1970s onward, you know, kind of roughly at the same time as, you know, the Green Revolution was happening and ecological awareness was being raised in environmentalist circles and things like that.
So I wanted to ask a little bit more about this cultural argument that you make, the connection that you draw between what are often quite technical and recondite conversations happening among scientists within the scientific community on the one hand, and broader cultural discourse on the other hand. So we've already touched upon the connection between Victorian naturalists like Charles Lyell and Darwin thinking about natural selection, evolutionary progress, vis-a-vis the British Empire, right? Imperialism. I wanted to ask about the kind of resurgence of catastrophic thinking, neo-catastrophism, in the mid-20th century, mid to late 20th century, where you draw a connection to postmodern culture, but also very strongly draw a connection to the fears about a nuclear holocaust, nuclear winter. So I wanted to ask you if you could draw out those connections a little bit more fully. So what was the kind of broader cultural context in which people like Dave Raup, your dad, Stephen Jay Gould, and others were returning to these Cuvierian catastrophist theories, and how you think you can draw out these connections?
Yeah, so thanks. So one of the arguments that I make in the book is that this wasn't actually as sudden a shift as it might look, at least culturally. One of the things that I think in the third chapter of the book I argue is that from the beginning of the 20th century onward, there's a more pessimistic turn in cultural, I guess we could say cultural self-satisfaction, in a sense. Like Europeans began to be more pessimistic about the future of their societies, Europeans and Americans, right? So you see like the birth effectively of post-apocalyptic science fiction right around 1895. And this has close connections with what we might call a kind of pessimistic modernism that flourished, you know, before and after World War I, marked by works like Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West, that predicted that, you know, European society was decadent or in decline or degenerate, and that there were cyclical patterns in history that governed the rise and fall of civilizations. And that this was actually quite closely mirrored by scientific ideas about extinction and about patterns of extinction and evolution in the fossil record. You know, cyclical thinking about extinction theories like orthogenesis, et cetera, as you well know, were quite popular in the later 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly among paleontologists. And so, so basically, the argument is that the book doesn't simply argue that extinction is related to cultural attitudes about diversity, biological and cultural diversity, but also, again, about our imaginations, our hopes and fears about the present and the future. So that kind of Victorian positivism pretty quickly around World War I becomes a kind of pessimistic modernism, right? Linked up with a pessimistic modernism. And that just simply carries forward after the Second World War and into the Cold War, right? I mean, even worse things happen during the Second World War. You have the Holocaust and you have the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the, you know, extraordinary casualties that result from that conflict. And then that kind of merges into the Cold War anxieties about nuclear annihilation, which provide a kind of canvas, I think, upon which scientists are kind of paint their ideas. And I argue that scientists are both drawing influence from this culture. I mean, they're members of their own cultures, and also contributing to it. So by the time we get to the 1970s, when people are really seriously starting to reconsider mass extinctions, you're at the late Cold War moment where the arsenals of the Soviet Union and the United States are at all-time highs, and the vision of the past represented by the paleontologists who are presenting periodic annihilations matches up pretty closely with the fears that people have in Western culture about the present and the future. And that's kind of dramatically illustrated in the 1980 hypothesis that Louis and Walter Alvarez et al. Presented, the famous asteroid extinction or impact extinction hypothesis, which essentially wrote nuclear war onto the fossil record. And it's not coincidental that, right, Louis Alvarez, the father of Walter Alvarez, who is a geologist, Louis Alvarez was a nuclear physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and helped develop the hydrogen bomb. What I kind of argue is that these cultural and scientific threads are dancing around each other for much of the 20th century and come slamming together very vividly in the 1980s, in the early 1980s. And this is around the time when the editorial by the syndicated columnist Alan Goodman appeared that I talk about in my book. I don't actually have the title of that handy, that editorial. I can't remember what it was called. But it effectively said, does every culture get the dinosaur extinction story it deserves? And she argued that indeed the impact hypothesis was the dinosaur extinction hypothesis that the late 20th century deserved. And I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So let's pull that thread of tapestry of threads, cultural scientific threads, forward into our own time. So you end the book with current anxieties about the sixth extinction, and questions about whether that is a mass extinction event that's already underway, anthropogenic mass extinction event. And you're thinking about Anthropocene. So how, again, these broader cultural anxieties, worries about diversity, biodiversity, other kinds of diversity loss, link up with scientific concerns in geology and paleontology.
Yeah. One of the final big arguments I make in the book is that, these extinction imaginaries change over time, right? There are different extinction imaginaries for different cultural moments. And the current extinction imaginary, I argue, that we are now living with in the 21st century is modified. It's not the exact same one. It's not your parents' extinction imaginary. It's not the extinction imaginary that I grew up with as a teenager when I would, have nightmares about, mushroom clouds and things like that. The current imaginary understands the catastrophe that we are experiencing as a more drawn out or perhaps slow motion catastrophe, right? So in the early 20th century, there was a fear that, like cycles of biological extinction and evolution, human culture went through these kind of preordained cycles, and that Western culture might be at the end of one such cycle. And that's what Spengler argued, for example, to an imaginary that in which, the sudden event, right, the catastrophic event in the blink of an eye was the kind of dominant extinction imaginary and reflected both views of, fears about nuclear annihilation and as well as you know, the sudden extinction of the dinosaurs, which it was hypothesized at the time that perhaps all major mass extinction events were caused by bolide impacts, by asteroid impacts, and that idea has now been kind of dismissed. It's now understood that mass extinctions have a variety of different causes, to a notion of catastrophe as being something drawn out, something that we're actually living through. And this is where some of the postmodernism gets into it, in the sense that we have already experienced the catastrophe and we're just living out its consequences, right? And that slower motion notion of catastrophe fits the processes of, you know, climate change and other drivers of what scientists suspect, you know, is causing the current biodiversity crisis, and as well as what threatens human societies with sea level rise and temperature change and things like that. So what I kind of argue for is a succession of these different extinction imaginaries, all of which are related to one another, but which reflect kind of distinct cultural sensibilities. And I do very much feel that our current cultural sensibility, and the one that's reflected in the Anthropocene, is a kind of much more resigned and fatalistic sensibility, right? I mean, you have a slew of authors these days, you know, writing books like The Uninhabitable Earth, which essentially argue that there's nothing we can really do about it. We can mitigate, perhaps, but there's nothing we can do to, there's nothing we can really do to radically change the course that we've set ourselves on, and that we're going to have to live with the consequences. And at the same time, you know, the way that scientists understand extinction as a biological and historical process, now the role of climate change is kind of dominant as an explanation for many of the major mass extinctions of the geologic past, including the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. And this has to do with the environmental effects of an asteroid impact, but volcanism is also implicated. So volcanoes and the greatest extinction of all time, the Permian, the extinction at the end of the Permian that saw maybe as much as 95% of the Earth's standing diversity wiped out, is pretty robustly tied to an episode of extraordinary climate change, which we may be rivaling in our current moment, from an anthropogenic source rather than a naturally occurring one in the Earth.
So as a final question, I wanted to return to this idea that you spoke about earlier of methodological presentism. And it's about, so the book ends with a reflection on the Anthropocene and the sixth extinction. Yeah. And I'm wondering about it, for a book that I'm going to sort of oversimplify a little bit, and I apologize, I couldn't put it quite bluntly, but for a book that essentially argues that these ideas about extinction are socially constructed, that they're not purely scientific, they're not objective ideas, do you worry about the kind of conclusion that some readers might draw about the sixth mass extinction? That, oh, well, this is just a cultural anxiety. This isn't something that we really need to worry about, and therefore I can go and buy the largest SUV that I might want, or, you know, jet set all around the world and not have to concern myself too much with global climate change.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I actually make an even blunter point, which is that a lot of the arguments, the scientific arguments in support of the so-called sixth extinction, involve some questionable extrapolation of data sources. The claim that 74 species per day are becoming extinct, for example, which E.O. Wilson kind of famously promoted, that this, you know, that a lot of that rhetoric was based on, you know, fairly questionable, tentative, even flimsy, one might say, data sources. I don't in any way want to dissuade people from being concerned about, you know, biological diversity, about climate change. These are the important challenges of our time, maybe of, you know, the entire history of humanity. If we're going to, you know, if we're going to survive into the next century. At the same time, I think that it is healthy for our political discourse for, you know, not just academics like us, but general readers to have a healthy appreciation of the political and cultural dimensions of science and not to, you know, not to cleanly separate scientific and broader cultural discourse in the way that, you know, we historians have learned kind of, you know, not to do this. And so while I absolutely don't mean to imply that, you know, that science is purely a social construct, right? That knowledge about the world is entirely subjective or something like that in some way. I do want readers to bear in mind that, you know, that what our science tells us is embedded in a set of cultural values because there are other dimensions of, you know, our social and political lives in which we should be skeptical of science. For example, when science and scientists are talking about things like race and other, you know, values that are both, you know, scientific and cultural, right? So, so in other words, I guess I want to make the case that we can, I guess we can feel a greater kind of investment in the big scientific issues of our time if we have a sense of how, you know, those issues are cultural and political as well as just scientific, right? I mean, if there's a clean split between science and culture, then only scientists should really be worried about science, and only scientists should really be discussing science, and only scientists should be allowed to be critical of science. And I think, you know, in a healthy functioning democracy, we should all have an investment in that. And if that means asking, you know, awkward questions, then I think that that's okay. You know, at the end of the day, I do believe that science is a somewhat self-correcting process, but it can only, you know, really self-correct if we're, you know, looking at its cultural impact as well as, you know, just kind of the purely intellectual internal scientific impact as well, right? And so science hasn't fully self-corrected on certain topics. Race is a big one. I'm thinking about that a lot because my next book is going to be about science and race. But, you know, because of this attitude that, you know, there are kind of two distinct spheres.
Well, thank you so much, David, and congratulations on the publication of this book.
Thank you very much, Lucas. It was my pleasure, and it's great to talk to you.